You're listening to the Great Day in Sales podcast, brought to you by Alessio. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. Today, I have with me Toni Bennett. We were able to catch up just a few weeks ago, talk to her a little bit about a pretty impressive journey. She's been a part of companies at the very earliest stages and seen them go from 0 to 20 million in ARR. So she's going to have an incredible story to tell, a lot of interesting ways that we can apply her experiences to our own. Really excited to be talking to you today, Toni.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you have a fascinating background, lots of success. I'm sure there's been some bumps along the way as well, but why don't you get things started off by just walking us through kind of your journey to where you are now?
Sure. I am one of those crazy people who likes early stage business and startup, despite all the chaos. I started my journey in sales at UPS, which is a great company, but not the most fun place to be in sales. It was very, and maybe it's changed by now, right? It's been a while, but very like cube village, 200 people in a call center. And I thought, man, this is what my life is going to be like as an adult. And then I was very fortunate to jump on board a startup at Pardot, which at the time was, they've just been rated top place to work in Atlanta. So there was like a lot of buzz around this cool startup and everything really changed. I saw how fun sales could be. Working at a tech startup with a bunch of people who were also in their 20s, all with their different personalities, showing value to customers, having, you know, interesting conversations. I thought, this is so fun. I want to do this for the rest of my career. And so I really dove deep into my work, spent a lot of time just trying to be a student of how do I get better and better at this craft. And so anyway, fast forward, I had an excellent leader there at Pardot, Derek Grant, who is still a great sales leader here in Atlanta. I wanted to do what he had done in building a team. There was so much he did to inspire me and help me achieve heights that I had not expected as a young person. So when I went to Terminus, I helped build the sales org from the ground up, from 0 to 20 million in revenue. That was a 4-year sprint. After that, I did a stint consulting. I worked at Twilio, which was a much larger company. Mm-hmm. A lot of good lessons, a lot of things that I had kind of skipped working at a startup that I got some great like discipline, being forced to have to speak to your forecast, like the back of your hand, when two or three levels of leaders above you can just like slack you out of the blue and ask about a deal. The depth of how to manage people there was really important for me to gain. Anyway, now I'm a VP of sales at Daily, which is also API company, similar to Twilio. We're in the video space.
Fascinating. And I want to, you had mentioned that 0 to 20 million at Terminus, and something that you had mentioned when we were chatting before the podcast was, I mean, it really was zero. They were not doing founder-led sales. There was no kind of, there's no process or really any sales operations for you to come into. It was like you were the first salesperson and you built all that out. So that's kind of, that's probably the where I'd like to focus for now, and we'll kind of go from there. But just what was that like? I mean, so much unknown. You have to figure out so much on your own. What was that like for you?
It was so fun. It was chaotic, but it was fun. I mean, maybe it's a little unfair for me to say no founder-led sales. Our founder had initially, while they were trying to build a product, they were selling services. And as they learned what customers want, they built a product. But when I came on board, you know, there were really no customers on that product. So yeah, it's interesting how advice has changed over time and founder-led sales often goes farther. But I was also super junior. They didn't have to pay a lot of money to bring me on board at that stage. So it was kind of like, instead of founder-led selling, find an account executive who's really good at selling to this buyer who's willing to come in and build things. But it was, in some ways, it was easy for me because I wasn't coming from a leadership role where I wanted to bring a playbook and just manage people. I was a practitioner and I did know the buyer really well. So when I came in, my brain was just flooded with yeah, how do I sell this? And how do I start to enable other people to sell this? And everything I did was problem solving. I really think the most important skill for virtually any job, but especially in sales and sales leadership, is getting good at problem solving. That is what my job has been the last years, is constant, what's the next problem that needs to be solved and how do I work through it? And so something I learned, we talked about this a lot, in the early days, I thought somebody else will have the answer. So I had this coalition of VPs of sales, CROs from other companies, including Derek, who I'd worked for before. And I would call him and just expect that this person would give me, here is the answer. And I realized really quickly that they all had great advice, great experience. I could learn from what they shared. But ultimately, I had to take all of that and then think about how it might apply to our business and figure out what worked for us. And I learned the power of doing small pilots of things before fully committing. Let's do something, let's see how it works, and let's tinker and tinker. So a lot of learnings during that time. But I think in hindsight, as I look back, I think part of the reason I had success was I approached it as very humbly and as I am here to just tinker and figure things out versus to pretend that I'm the expert and I know what I'm doing and everything.
Yeah, no, I love that. And you said something that there's a clear difference between figuring out how to sell something and figuring out how to enable people to sell that thing, mm-hmm. right? Can you unpackage that a little bit? Because at the end of the day, like, I love that you said, hey, you know, if we could all hire a Tony Bennett to come in, that'd be fairly cheap at first and like really just crush it, right? That'd be amazing. A lot of companies would love to do that. But there's kind of two phases, right? You came in, you had to find success really early on, and then you have to scale and basically enable other people to be able to sell it as well. What's the difference there? Like how separate are those two projects of figuring out how to sell something and then figuring out how to enable people to sell it?
That's a great question. Oh, I didn't think about it exactly that way. They're definitely different things. I would get frustrated at first because I have a certain learning style. I'm someone who's not afraid to role play. So if you were like, just ring, ring, cold called me, I'd go with it. And even if I said something dumb, I don't feel embarrassed. I think that's the fun of, you know, learning to do things, just on the go. A lot of people don't work that way. So I would try to impose my way on people and realize pretty quickly that you've got to find multiple different ways to get a point across. But a big theme that I didn't fully learn at Terminus until later, I focused too much on perfectionism. I wanted to have this perfectly outlined process, and I wanted people to be able to do it perfectly every time the way that I wanted them to do it. And it took me a while to learn that it's better to give someone a framework that's higher level that explains what you're doing and why. The goal of a first call is to learn these things and to share these things. And no matter what, you can't get off the call until you've accomplished these three things. Then you can have videos, role plays, you can have a script, you can have things that you give people so if they learn that way, they can leverage that resource. But giving the higher level framework and then allowing people to figure out how they need to learn and having some flexibility, not being so rigid with how you train people. And that I just learned by doing it. You know, I had some reps who wanted to sit in a corner and talk to themselves and talk things out. I had some people who were writers and they would kind of write out scripts. And by writing, they were learning things. Some people who wanted to do more role playing. Some people learn better on the job. Other people want to be a perfectionist and learn everything before they dove in. So I do think there is a special art to figuring out how to teach things to other people. But sorry, I know I'm going on a bit, but I do think one of the biggest themes, the stop being a perfectionist, was really important to say, if I spend all this extra energy trying to coach someone from being 85% to 90%, does that little bit extra perfection in the process lead to a big enough increase in productivity or revenue, or am I wasting energy and effort on something that isn't going to make that much of an impact? So part of that learning was also give people frameworks and let people work in them. Definitely coach people, but overthinking it, it does not allow you to scale a business well.
Yeah, no, I like that. And yeah, that's a big question I think a lot of managers face is, okay, is it worth like tons of time to add that extra 5%? Really, your job is to get them kind of to an adequacy level and then they can take it from there. Another thing you said, Tony, was that I thought was very beneficial was just, hey, every single call, whether it's that discovery call or whatever stage, but you need to find some things out and you need to say a few things. You need to share a few things. It was like that resonated with me just as you kind of build those frameworks for your team. You say, hey, you're going to do a lot of things to figure out the best way for you to sell, practice writing, do role play, a lot of different things. But at the end of the day, we really need you to get some information and also share some specific things on that call. Yeah. And I feel like that's a great way to kind of scale a team.
I think too many people just think about what I need to know and they don't always. Okay. So two big mistakes I see in building sales process. One, you give them the exact questions instead of here is the theme or the goal of what you want to get out of it. Because then someone asks the question, when they don't get the right response, they move on anyway. Versus you need to understand, you know, I'm thinking about a customer, someone I consult with on the side. One of the big things they need to figure out, they sell the K-12. Sometimes buyers will just like, yeah, that sounds good. And they'll be really polite. So one of the things they need to do early is figure out, is this kind of person really serious about wanting to make a change? And are they just saying yes to me? Or are they actually really someone who can get this done in their organization? And so you can't just give a question or ask the question, are you someone who is going to help me push this forward? Like, can you be a change agent in your business? You have to find other ways to get there. So by giving the bigger picture goals versus specific questions. But the other thing is, again, if we're only asking for ourselves and just trying to get information, we're not giving something of value, we may never get the opportunity to speak with them again. So I think that's an important thing to add at every stage of the sales process. What should I be trying to get, but what should I also be giving that I think is valuable?
Yeah. The give value is so, especially in 2023 going into 2024, like that's the role of a salesperson, right? We've also had, we're based in kind of this startup community, just like you in Atlanta, not the main Silicon Valley, but this awesome tech hub. And yeah, we have technical founders and founders that don't have a sales bone in their body and they come to us and they say, hey, I need to learn how to sell. And so much of that, like you just, you know, that's kind of leads into my next question of taking that product at Terminus from 0 to 20. Were there different selling stages that you kind of had to unlock, or was it just kind of similar framework all 4 years that you grew that, or, you know, where did you have to kind of make some big changes once you solve one problem, something else broke? Like walk us through kind of the different selling stages there.
It's so funny when I've talked to, especially first time founders, and they're thinking in their head, like, I want someone who can come in and create process in the first 6 months, and then they're just going to scale the business. It doesn't work like that. It's really these two things. You're building, scaling, then you're building again, and you're scaling. It's a constant cycle. I mean, even at 20 million, we were still finding there were things that were changing every year. So every year, at least, if not every 6 months, it almost felt like a new business. Certainly the journey from 0 to 1, 1 to 5, 5 to 10, and 10 to 20, each felt like their own story, their own journey. And at each phase, I would look again at things like our SDR to AE ratios, our conversion rates through the funnel. As the market matured, for instance, since we were in a newer market, initially we would see a lot more interest in the first call, but the conversion rate forward would be lower because a lot of these companies weren't ready for this technology. They didn't really know what it was. And we see a lot more drop off over time. We would generate less meetings, but our conversion rate really started to go up because more of these customers really knew what ABM was and were interested in buying technology for it. And so at different phases, we had to figure out which part of our conversion rate do we think is most important to focus on and what enablement do we put towards that to optimize that particular variable in the sales motion. But definitely, I now, when I'm advising a company, say quarterly at a minimum, whatever your go-to-market model is that has all your assumptions for how you think you're going to get to the revenue number, at least quarterly, you should be looking back and see which conversion points are performing above or below what we put into the model or the plan, so you can reassess what things you might need to change in your process, your workflows to stay on track to hit or overachieve your plan.
Yeah, I love that 6 month cadence, half a year, kind of assess where you're at, what things have changed. I mean, there's macroeconomic things that happen that makes, you know, buyers kind of rethink things, change how they're approaching the problem. And maybe the technology is really new as well. And so it's you said something that kind of struck a nerve with us too at our stage. Just people are very open to kind of help startups, but sometimes you can get incorrect information from them because of that. They're overly positive, but they may not actually end up becoming a deal for you. So you really have to kind of figure out that right approach, and you nailed it, getting those questions answered of like, okay, is this person actually looking for a solution? Are they going to help push this deal forward? I think that's huge.
That goes back to problem solving. I could give someone tips on how to do things based on how we do them at daily, but that might not be relevant. So this company that I've been doing some advising for, they have no problem setting meetings. They are setting a ton of meetings. I wish my team set so many meetings. But again, the conversion rate of buyers who are really serious, buyers who aren't in a long-term contract, there's other variables they need to consider. And so we focused a lot on how to weed out a lot more people more quickly. To some degree, how to get more of a self-service motion going. But then what are some ways that we can help bring them along with us? Sometimes it makes sense to help them build a business plan. Sometimes it makes sense to give them a one-sheeter they can take and present to the, there's like a school board sometimes they have to present to. But like, how can you figure out where your buyer is getting held up and make it easier for them to progress? And to your point, sometimes that changes over time. So if you stick too rigidly to what worked, you may start seeing less success with that sales motion.
Yeah. What, Tony, what are some clear, obviously listeners of the podcast, they're going to be, you know, we know that many of them are sales leaders or budding sales leaders, right? ICs that are really interested in their potentially their first sales leadership role. What are some principles, you know, you've been at enough, you've sold for enough products and services now, different logos, different companies, you're even advising on the side. Like, you've probably uncovered some principles that maybe apply, you know, to most sales leadership roles. Do you have any of those that you'd be willing to share with our audience?
Just like tips for sales leaders.
Yeah.
Such a broad question. There's so many ways we could go with that. I by no means am a perfect leader. I mess up plenty. I think we all do. So being willing to listen to feedback and to have a feedback loop, often our teams are not going to tell us directly if they don't like something their boss is doing. So one thing they did at Twilio that I've adopted is finding ways to give your team ways to give you real unfiltered feedback. That could be anonymous surveys. It can also be asking them at your quarterly review when you're reviewing their performance to ask them. And over time, as you build trust with them, they should be giving you more and more honest responses. But find ways to add feedback cycles so you can understand how things might need to be tweaked and changed.
I love that. One thing, Tony, you said to me was you have to avoid perfectionism in this business, right? That's one too that and I think you do that by being very open to feedback. And, you know, the managers in my career that there wasn't that relationship established or something for some reason was off and you weren't able to be transparent and give one another feedback. I think that was kind of detrimental to the team. Have you seen that as well?
Yes. The way that you are with anyone impacts the way you're perceived by everyone. So if you give favoritism to some people, if you keep someone even though they're not performing, those send signals to the rest of the team about who you are and how you lead. And so, you know, I think you have to really think about how the team is perceiving the way that you interact with them and how you work with them. And so I realized, and I posted about this recently on LinkedIn, when I was at Terminus, I was a pretty intense sales leader. It was partially because I was pretty young. I was female, managing a bunch of guys, many of whom were older than myself. And I was emulating other leaders that I had worked under who were very tough, hard-nosed sales leaders. And so that initial style was very much a come in and prove to me you'll have what it takes. And that worked when I was at a startup where we were all in the same office. They got to know me outside of work. So they knew I cared about them. I really wanted them to be successful. When I was hard on them, I was hard equally on everyone. We all made fun of each other. And so it was that kind of environment. When I went to Twilio and I was managing a totally different rep profile, we went remote very quickly after COVID. Me being hard on them made them hate me. And I realized that wasn't an effective way to build their trust. And so I had to change my approach some. And I realized how do I want to be managed? I don't want to go into a VP of sales role and have a CEO like come in and prove to me you have what it takes. I'm just looking at the numbers and performance. And I'm not going to give you that much feedback, right? The way my current CEO is amazing. And he has very much said, I know your background, your track record. We think you're amazing. You come in and build a plan and let us know what you need. And giving someone that space and giving them trust initially, of course, then you have to hold them accountable if they can't do the job. That's a problem. But starting the relationship with your team and any new hire as a, I believe in you, I'm confident you can do the job, and I'm here to help you do it. Now, you have to come in and do the things and hit the numbers, or you're not going to stay here. But just that little change in mindset, I think, did wonders for how I have since managed teams and built culture. So even if we're going through a hard time, the team knows they can trust me and have very honest conversations about how they're feeling, and know that I will try to adapt or help in any way I can.
Yeah, that was great, great answer, Tony. I mean, I can tell, and I'm sure everyone can tell, you really do care about your teams, which, I mean, every team manager ideally would have some level of that, right? But I feel like especially in sales, you got to have your people's back, and that's great that you shared. So I'd love to send you off with this, because we typically ask this question of all our guests. What does a great day in sales look like to you? Reality is you can't close the 6-7 plus figure deal every day. And if someone is doing that, please if someone's doing that, please contact me. We'd love to have you on the podcast. That is an amazing day when you get those big sales, but that habitual motion, what you're doing every day to make every day great, what does a great day in sales look like to you?
The way I think about it now is that, like, for the end seller, what a great day is a day when you've done the right actions that lead you to a sale, whether or not it's closing on this day or not. And I think that's different in each sales organization. When I was at Twilio, I realized that judging the number of calls or emails someone made had zero impact on telling me if they were going to hit their number or not. We were more of an account management kind of sale. But the amount of time they spent with their top billing accounts and the amount of stakeholders they were communicating within those accounts directly told me who was going to hit their number and who wasn't. So in that particular model, a successful day, whether or not you get a deal done, is a day that you are doing those leading indicators that will lead you towards a deal. And I think that's what's hard about sales. A lot of us are motivated by the win or the paycheck or whatever that exciting thing is. But a successful day is knowing that you did everything you could in your power to get you to the best outcome.
I love it. That hits home. We're big fans of leading indicators over here at Alessio, and I think that was great. I mean, how many stakeholders, how many, you know, champions have you talked to as a part of the deal? That's a huge one. And I don't think it's a harder one to track, right? You can see how many phone calls have gone out and how many and things like that. But kind of honing in on the deal, doing that deal analysis and seeing really what's going on is huge. So great answer. Great answer. Tony, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Obviously, a fantastic experience, and thank you for sharing it with us. I hope there's some things that our listeners can take home right away, and we'll be watching you. You're obviously doing wonderful things at every business that you've been at today, now where you're at, and obviously your projects on the side. If you'd love to work more with Tony, I'm sure she'd be available to be contacted. But thank you so much for being on the podcast. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right. We'll see you. Thanks for listening to the Great Day in Sales podcast. Check us out at podcast.alessio.ai or anywhere you stream podcasts.